Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Delaware Valley School Board makes a unanimous decision to drop transgender protections after receiving a federal funding warning. Kimberly Izar was at the school board meeting and has reactions from parents, students, and community members. Pennsylvania and New Jersey are teaming up to crack down on aggressive driving, and despite fewer overall traffic deaths, fatal crashes tied to dangerous driving are on the rise. Coming up, what drivers need to know as enforcement ramps up across the region. Beyond the Borscht Belt, a new online class explores the deeper story of Yiddish culture, politics, and life in the Catskills. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi has the details. Plus, the latest local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. Coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Over the weekend, President Trump had warned the U.S. would bomb Iranian power plants if Iran did not open the Strait of Hormuz. That would be to allow all oil tankers and ships to pass. Trump gave a 48-hour deadline that was going to expire tonight. But this morning, Trump released a new statement online saying the U.S. and Iran have had very good and productive conversations. U.S. stock markets have skyrocketed. The Dow Jones Industrials jumped 850 points. NPR's Aya Batrawi has more.
Trump says that based on the tenor and depth of the conversations, he's instructed the U.S. military to hold off on striking any Iranian power plants and energy infrastructure for 5 days as talks continue throughout the week. But Iran says there is no dialogue with Washington. Iran's state broadcaster published a statement from the Iranian Foreign Ministry saying that while there are efforts by countries in the region to reduce tensions, Trump's statement is aimed at reducing energy prices in order to gain time to implement his military plans. Iran had threatened to target power plants in Dubai and other Gulf Arab cities if its power plants are bombed. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
New York's LaGuardia Airport is closed after a deadly collision between a passenger plane arriving from Montreal and a fire truck that was on the runway. Officials say two pilots were killed. Steve Kastenbaum reports federal aviation investigators are there.
The nose of the Air Canada regional jet was completely demolished when it slammed into a fire truck that was crossing the runway just as the plane landed at LaGuardia late last night. Port Authority officials say the pilot and co-pilot were killed. 41 people were taken to nearby hospitals, some with serious injuries. Most have since been released. Two police officers who were on that fire truck were also injured. They were called out to respond to a report of an odor in another passenger jet. For NPR News, I'm Steve Kastenbaum at LaGuardia Airport in New York.
The partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security is in its fifth week. Americans are feeling some of the strain at airports. Transportation Security Administration workers are going without pay. Starting today, President Trump says he's deploying federal immigration agents to airports to help TSA checkpoints. NPR's Luke Garrett says Trump has put his border czar, Tom Homan, in charge.
Homan said, you know, he was still working with TSA and ICE to finalize a deployment plan. Homan called the operation a, quote, work in progress. But he did give some parameters on the tasks ICE will and won't be doing. Homan said he expects ICE agents to guard exits and entry points at the nation's busiest airports. And he told CNN ICE agents will leave the specialized security work to TSA.
And NPR's Luke Garrett, but the president of the Union for TSA Workers, condemned the plan. He said ICE agents are untrained and that they are going to make airport security worse. You're listening to NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court is examining the case of mail-in ballots today and whether some state laws should be changed. The question is whether ballots should be counted as long as they're postmarked by Election Day but may get there a few days late. Several states have this grace period. A growing number of people are on GLP-1 drugs seeking to lose weight, but many are not getting counseling about how their diet also needs to change while they take the medication. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more.
Ideally, GLP-1 drugs enable people to change their diet for the better. That means eating more protein to combat muscle loss that occurs on the drugs. High-fiber foods are necessary because the medicines slow digestion, potentially causing blockage in the gut. In reality, however, many do not alter their eating habits because they're able to lose weight anyway. Or some skip meals and eat more rich foods, which can cause side effects like nausea or stomach problems. Nutritionists say changing one's diet is crucial, especially since data show about half of people quit GLP-1s within a year, then rapidly regain weight. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
The UN has released a report saying the time period between 2015 and 2025 was the hottest ever recorded on Earth. The World Meteorological Organization says the planet's heating up because humans are burning fossil fuels. The extra heat is responsible for deadly heat waves, droughts, and heavy rainstorms that cause torrential flooding. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Some school districts nationwide face a tough choice. Keep their protection policies for transgender students in place or risk losing Title IX funding. In Pike County, Pennsylvania, the Trump administration sent a letter to the Delaware Valley School District threatening just that. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was at the school board meeting on Thursday night where the board voted to abruptly drop its policy.
In a packed school library on Thursday night, the Delaware Valley School District Board unanimously voted to remove gender identity and gender expression as a protected status in its discrimination policy.
Pike Autism Support Services.
Kids are going to die.
Excuse me.
Kids are going to die.
And a loss of rental fees compounds $600.
That's after the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights threatened to open a federal investigation if the district did not change its policy. Transgender students in the district will now be required to use bathrooms and locker rooms that match their sex assigned at birth, regardless of their gender identity. Some community members said that the decision conflicts with Pennsylvania state law, which legally protects transgender students from discrimination. Isabella Azzolini, a queer student alumni, used to be proud to say where she went to school, but now not so much. She says the decision will negatively change the lives of many.
Mainly women, trans people, and LGBT people. So it's going to make everyone feel unsafe and scared and not able to be themselves.
For the last 10 years, the Delaware Valley School District has had an agreement with the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, that mandates greater transgender protection policies. This was after a lawsuit from a transgender student who said that the school district violated their Title IX rights and won. Last month, Superintendent Dr. Brian Blum received a letter from OCR that the Trump administration had terminated the agreement, saying it violated Title IX. If the school district did not comply, OCR would open an investigation into the school district, according to the letter. School board members say that they could also risk losing federal funding. Board President Jessica Decker said the district had 30 days to respond.
We had a deadline of March 24th in order to comply, or we were going to be investigated by OCR and potentially lose our federal funding. So that is what the vote was about tonight. And then Dr. Blum and our administrative team, they met with our students to talk to them prior to as soon as we got the letter and we made it public last week. At our work session, our administrators, our social workers met with our students that it was going to impact so that they were aware of it prior to the vote so that they could get feedback from the students as to how best to support them during this process, because we do know that it's going to impact them on a day-to-day basis.
At the school board meeting, Attorney Brian Taylor recommended that the school district comply.
The third thing that this letter does is it tells us what we need to do next. It gives us that direction. We need to rescind those policies that are in place. It's clear whether we agree or disagree. It's a direction that we've been given. The fourth thing that this document does, it gives us some certainty or ideas to what we face if we don't do it. And that would be in the form of a directed investigation. This is something that OCR has started doing probably for the past year or so. Their focus has moved away from the typical sexual assault or sexual discrimination that it looked at before in the past. And it's focused primarily on sports and transgender issues. And these investigations have been targeted on that. I can say that the majority of these investigations do end against the school district.
OCR has sent similar Title IX violations to public schools across the country regarding their transgender inclusion policies. In Colorado, Jefferson County schools have pushed back against the Trump administration, saying its policies comply with Title IX. All nine board members voted to comply with the federal directive on Thursday evening.
Christine Agon? Yes. Jessica Decker?
Yes.
Brian Fells?
Yes.
Jack Fisher?
Yes.
Pam Lutfi?
Yes.
Felicia Sheehan?
Yes.
Dorrit Smith?
Yes.
Rosemary Walsh?
Yes.
Carl Will?
Yes.
That's nine yeses. Motion carried. Howard.
Wow.
Community members were divided on how the school board should respond to the letter. Taylor James, executive director for local LGBTQ plus nonprofit Triversity Center, started his public comments with a message for the LGBTQ plus students in the district.
To each and every one of you, I need you to know that you belong here exactly as you are, and that we see you, and the entire community behind me sees you. You are perfect the way you are, no matter what happens in this room tonight.
James says the federal actions were a, quote, blatant overstep from the Department of Education, end quote.
And my biggest question is, how will this be enforced? Who gets to discern between transgender and cisgender students? What does that process look like? Do you feel safe having your daughters evaluated by school officials? While supporters of this elimination would like you to think we are talking about grown men, we are not. We're talking about children, boys and girls, students, your children. We know that removing these protections would put all students in more danger at Delaware Valley, and for what? In the 10 years that this policy has been in place, there has not been a single incident or issue in our bathrooms. What are we doing here? Why is this what we're talking about? Perhaps our time and our tax dollars would be better spent focusing on how we can improve our district and help our students thrive, rather than focusing on which students we can discriminate against and where everyone can pee. I implore you all to take a moment to consider the weight of this decision. I'd like to read you a comment from a parent in a district that was posted this afternoon on Triversity's page. If you want to keep the weirdos, then fund a bathroom for them. And if they get made fun of until they commit suicide, so be it. Thank you.
But Pike County resident Matthew Contreras thinks the board made the right decision.
I think the question of gender identity is something that should be left out of schools.
About a dozen attendees offered public comment, including a spokesperson from Pennsylvania Representative Tara Probes, who serves Monroe and Pike counties, and read a letter from Probes.
I'm hoping that the Delaware Valley School Board would not roll back the Office of the Civil Rights Agreement that put in place protections for people of different races, religions, origins, and sexual orientations. Of all the issues that face our students' ability to obtain a quality education, why is this a priority? What is next? Rolling back Black history? Rolling back the rights that women have fought for? Rolling back our own history in the United States and abroad? Nobody is going to agree on any one issue, but it doesn't mean the issue doesn't exist. Rolling back a civil rights agreement is important to a number of students and teachers in your district, as well as constituents. I appreciate the Delaware Valley School District. I really do. I especially think you have a fantastic superintendent who is always there to help, to take advantage of grant money, as he should, and who really cares about his students, all of them. There is a separation of church and state for a reason. So please put aside any ill will feelings you may have about certain populations, and remember that your job is to consider the well-being of all of the student body, not picking and choosing who you think is deserving. This is public education, and we are diverse. We are strong, and we will always fight for all of our kids, no matter what the social climate is. Thank you for listening, and please don't put your personal preferences above the needs of students in your district. After all, they are the ones attending, their families are paying taxes, and they deserve the dignity, not the adults in the room. Tara Probst.
Superintendent Blum says that his main concern is to make sure district students feel taken care of. Studies show that LGBTQ plus youth report significantly higher rates of depression, anxiety, and lower self-esteem than their cisgender and heterosexual peers.
I would just like our students to know that when things like this happen and they're upset, to please come and speak to members of the school community so that they can have time to talk, have time to have someone listen to them and ask questions that they may have on their mind.
Sorry, one more question. Just in terms of the 10 years since this OCR agreement has been in place, have you had any issues and what has that looked like?
We have not had any bathroom or restroom issues involving discrimination or different classifications of people, no.
But James of Diversity Center is terrified for what comes next. He says the school board vote is just the beginning.
Unfortunately, we are well aware that members on the board here will not stop at bathrooms. We believe that this will be the first domino to fall and that all protections will be gone, not just for trans students, but for LGBTQ plus students. We think this is much more far-reaching. We think it's going to hurt every student, especially cisgendered girls, because who's enforcing this? And how are they enforcing this? And who gets to say what a woman is and all of that? The ramifications are scary. We know that this conversation leads to children questioning themselves. And I know personally how detrimental that can be to these kids in long term, to their mental health and their well-being.
The updated policy takes effect immediately. In Milford, Pennsylvania, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Meanwhile, yesterday in New York, dozens of people showed up in Utica for a trans rights rally. Randy Gordman of the New York Public News Network says organizers feel increased urgency to hold these kinds of demonstrations because of recent proposals and changes affecting the transgender community.
This was the third annual trans rights rally organized by the Oneida County Pride Alliance, and its founder and president, Ace Morreale, said the urgency has been driven by actions and comments that have come out of the Trump administration. Morreale said things are somewhat better in New York State in terms of respect for trans rights, but he said supporters of the trans community need to be vigilant.
So it's important that even though in New York State we're relatively safer, it still affects us. As people are fleeing red states, as these federal policies are going to come down on us, we have to stand strong to protect human rights.
Among those supporting the trans community at Sunday's rally was Kathy McDonald, who said it's important for everyone to speak out.
To let, you know, the general community know that there are many of us who are supportive, who aren't really a part of the trans community, but we're supportive of them. So it's important for them to know how many people are really supportive.
McDonald added that everyone should have the right to be themselves, and she said she doesn't like to see the federal government pitting people against each other. In Utica, Randy Gordman for the New York Public News Network.
Still to come, a closer look at the aggressive driving crackdown underway across Pennsylvania and New Jersey. What could get you pulled over during this enforcement wave? Stay with us. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Callison Stratton. Join me for a special live edition of Liberation Station Friday evening at the Parlor in Narrowsburg. We're celebrating Women's History Month and supporting Radio Catskill with drinks, raffles, and prizes from local women-owned businesses and live music from the Basic Bitches, iLeash, Masha Sokol, and more. $20 suggested donation at the door. Don't miss this live event, 7:30 Friday evening at the Parlor in Narrowsburg.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A new multi-state crackdown on aggressive driving is underway across Pennsylvania and New Jersey as officials respond to a troubling rise in deadly crashes tied to dangerous behavior behind the wheel. The enforcement effort, led by PennDOT State Police and hundreds of local departments, runs through April 26 with a coordinated high-visibility enforcement day planned for April 14th. To tell us more is PennDOT spokesperson Liz Fabry. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us discuss this.
So PennDOT is working with New Jersey to launch this multi-state aggressive driving crackdown. What's driving this effort right now?
Well, we've seen in our most updated results in 2024, 5,897 aggressive driving crashes, which is a big number. 106 of those resulted in fatalities, and 405 were serious injuries. That's just 2024. We don't have the official 2025 results released yet, but from what we're seeing, there's still an increase in aggressive driving. So we really are trying to get ahead and partner with our surrounding communities to just keep drivers safe.
And what's behind that trend of these aggressive driving fatalities, even as overall traffic deaths have declined?
You know, they gave us the general number. We would have to definitely look into that more. But I know from firsthand what I'm seeing and talking to my safety partners, it's a lot of the distracted driving, speeding, just not being patient. People are really tailgating others. But that distracted driving, you know, with our hands-free law going in, to place, we're hoping that we see a decrease in this as the years to come.
What are some of the behaviors you're most concerned about when it comes to aggressive driving?
So the main one that I see on a daily basis is tailgating. Other little things, running through stop signs, not giving enough space, speeding, that's a big one, especially with work zones coming up. It's going to be the start of construction season, and we often see that combined with speeding, tailgating. We see work zone crashes that hurts our employees, and that also can hurt the general public. We see that all the time. So definitely the tailgating is the biggest one that I see.
And when drivers are maybe caught in this enforcement period between now and April 26, what will they notice? Are there going to be a lot more physical presence, or how is this getting enforced?
Yeah, so there's just going to be more police presence. People looking out for things. I actually have a list of the main things that, you know, drivers could be getting cited
for.
Well,
let's remind folks what those are, yeah.
Yeah, so the biggest thing is making illegal U-turns, improper careless turning in the wrong lane from the wrong lane, proceeding without clearance after a stop, running stop signs, running a red light, failure to respond to another traffic control device, tailgating, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
Sudden slowing and stopping, careless passing or lane change, passing in a no passing zone, that's a big one, making an improper entrance to a highway, making improper exit from a highway, speeding, driving too fast for conditions. So spring is coming, we're going to see a lot of rain, so that's a big one. And driver fleeting police. So a lot of common things there that sound very simple, but we see them every day, especially the passing. I mentioned just trying to have some more patience with people, especially we're going to see changing weather conditions. We're still at a weird point with weather where some days it's cold, some days it's warm. So keeping that in mind when it comes to your speed.
How are Pennsylvania and New Jersey coordinating across state lines for this effort?
So they're partnering. They're often going to be in communication. So they're going to be discussing with one another the trends they're seeing. They're going to be communicating the issues as they arise, the different things like that, so that we can all kind of be unison in how in the future we're preventing these behaviors and these aggressive driving. So they're kind of just the biggest thing is the open communication, documenting everything we're seeing in the trends and things like that so we can get ahead of it and hopefully decrease any injuries or fatalities.
And if someone's caught driving aggressively, what kind of penalties are they facing?
So that often depends on the traffic stop or the issue that they're doing. But main thing you're going to be seeing is increased citations. So unfortunately, we noticed that when increased citations happen, people tend to really follow the behaviors. It should be about safety, but if it is about sometimes money or seeing a consequence, that does often change people's decision-making.
And you went through that list of things, which are some common sense things. Some people may associate aggressive driving with road rage, but those are two different behaviors. Can you kind of make the distinction between those two things?
So they are two different behaviors. Road rage is actually just somebody maybe getting really frustrated. That's when you see people with verbal altercations happening a lot of times, and that can escalate And nowadays, you never know. You know, we often see escalated behaviors with road rage that can result in a physical altercation, not just a verbal one. So that's something to keep in mind. With the aggressive driving, it's just that your behavior is a little intense. So, like, slow down. Don't be tailgating somebody. Like I mentioned, that's the biggest thing. And the aggressive driving is what could sometimes cause another person to have road rage. So it's changing that behavior before it gets to that point.
Road rage is actually a criminal offense, too, because it could be, you know, driving behavior that escalates, as you said, into some sort of an assault with a vehicle or other dangerous weapon.
And sometimes you think it's just beeping your horn and someone takes that personally, yeah. And it can escalate, like we said, into a verbal altercation, which then can become physical. Sometimes there's, dangerous weapons even involved nowadays. So it's really being mindful of that and keeping yourself safe, you know. Two, don't engage in those aggressive behaviors if you have family members in the car, kids in the car, things like that, because you just never know what could come out of that. And you can only be in control of your own behaviors. You can't control someone else's. That's the biggest takeaway here. So we're trying to keep everyone safe in that mindset.
And let's remind folks, if you encounter an aggressive driver, what you should do.
Yeah, so some of the things, you know, if you encounter an aggressive driver, get out of their way. Just stay as far away as possible. Do not engage with them. If you can, try to stay relaxed. Avoid eye contact. Ignore rude gestures. Try not to block the passing lane if you're driving slower than most traffic. So really just getting out of the way. Do not attempt to pursue or follow the vehicle. Although you might think, oh, I might be helping someone else. The best thing you can do is to defuse the situation by just getting out of the way if possible. And if you or your passenger are able to, you may call the police, but don't use your cell phone if you're the one, you know, driving. Don't take it hands-free. You know, make sure you're still staying hands-free. Don't take it and use it in your hands. Mm-hmm. And make sure you're in a safe location. But just try to give, you know, if you could, give the police the license plate and the description of the car. But the biggest thing in the moment is just to get out of the way and keep your safety in mind.
And what's the one thing you want folks to know if they're driving in Pennsylvania or New Jersey between now and end of April, April 26th, about this campaign?
Well, just pretty much you're in control of your own actions. So if you could help us and not drive aggressively, that'll help decrease and keep the general public safe. And we'll see less crashes, hopefully, in our upcoming data and less fatalities and injuries. I know with all the work and all the studies that I read, I definitely would love to see a decrease in that number, and it starts with safe behavior. So if you can participate and help us, it'll only help the general public.
All right, Liz Fabry from PennDOT talking about the multi-state campaign through Pennsylvania and New Jersey to combat aggressive driving. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
We'll take a break, and when we return, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the savage and sensuous bongos. Also, the traveling Wilburys of exotica music, the Surfmen. Plus some TV private eye jazz. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
We tend to think of depression as a disorder. But what if we saw it as an alert system?
And so I was forced to stop and reconsider and come up with a new life plan, which did ultimately put me on a path towards a more viable future for myself.
Rethinking Depression, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and every Monday we get to check in with James B. Huntington. A little local economic perspective. He's a local author and economist. James B., hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, there's some news in the stock market. Oil prices are tumbling, stocks are rising after President Trump announced some talks with Iran. We'll get to that later. But let's talk about what's happened in the news when it comes to interest rates. What happened with the interest rates last week?
Well, the Fed held them steady. That was no surprise. It was what everyone said they would do. What was surprising to me is that they admitted they didn't know anything about future meetings. So maybe they will raise them, maybe they'll lower them, maybe they'll stay the same. They've often acted like they had some advance agenda when they're supposed to be basing things on the data that is out then. But this time, even Powell said, the thing I want to really emphasize is that nobody knows. So they're going to be the same for a while, at least for the next month.
All right. Let's talk about some job fairs in our area coming up. There's three of them, I think you mentioned.
Yes, a whole flurry of them within not much over, within less than 2 weeks, a less than 2 weeks period. First, we have the Center for Workforce Development on March 31st. That's a week from tomorrow. It's at the Sullivan County Career Center, 50 North Street in Monticello. They don't say anything about employers who are going to be there, but no pre-registration required. Bring a resume and dress to impress. On-the-spot interviews may be offered. So it's between 11 and 2 on a week from Tuesday. The second one I have here is from the Pike County Commissioners, and it's Working Pike, the area's largest job fair, they claim. That's on Tuesday the 7th. So that is Tuesday the 7th is 2 weeks from tomorrow. It's called the 9th Annual Working Pike Job Fair. They're claiming more than 70 employers there who are expected to participate. Positions in a variety of industries. They're mentioning healthcare, hospitality, financial, manufacturing, law enforcement and corrections, recreation, sales, and more. From entry level to managerial, a lot of things. No fee, of course, and no RSVP necessary. It's going to run from 10 to 2 at the Best Western Inn at Hunt's Landing at 120 US 6 in Matamoros. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow. Then we have the SUNY Sullivan Regional Career and Job Fair that's going to be at the Sullivan, the SUNY Sullivan. What do they have here? I'm looking at this, trying to see. It will be at SUNY Sullivan, certainly. Okay. It's in the E-Lobby.
Yeah.
At 112 College Road in Loch Sheldrake. It's on Wednesday the 8th. That's one after the previous one I mentioned with Working Pike. One day after, it runs from 10 to 1. So, again, it's free and open to the public. There will be recruiters for different positions. They mention health care and human services, Garnet Health and the Center for Discovery, public service, the New York State Department of Parks and the Sullivan County Department of Public Health, workforce and arts, Sullivan County Workforce Development itself and Bethel Woods, and more. They are claiming that some of them are eager to hire. So, yes, you can also get, while you're there, a free professional headshot.
Oh, that's interesting.
So dress nicely again, and you can use it. It's always good to have a photo. You don't want to put them on resumes these days, but you do want to have such a thing available, especially for websites and situations where you may need it. So, three of these things.
Good to know. Three big job fairs in the region coming up. Let's move over to what's going on with gas oil prices. Specifically, it looks like there's some reports about U.S. car buyers showing a surge in interest in electric vehicles after the Trump administration's decision to attack Iran caused that major jump in gas prices. What should you know about electric cars when gas prices are surging?
Well, this is a good check-in because there's been a lot of information and the status of electric cars in the market has changed. But if you haven't been keeping track of it, if you're looking into, thinking about anyway, getting an electric car, here's what's happening now. Prices for new electric vehicles have fallen, but there's still an average of $6,500 more than fossil fuel vehicles. There are a lot of things to consider. There are different costs for different kinds of charging. It's hard to measure, but generally it is cheaper. It is more affordable. There are also a lot of cars in the next several months that are coming off of leases, so they're going to hit the market, so it will continue being relatively cheap. So otherwise, yes, it can be expensive. There are different speeds for charging. The fast ones are often more expensive even than gasoline, the fastest ones. But they require less maintenance because they don't need oil changes and they don't have fuel pumps and mufflers and other parts that have to be replaced. The bad news is they are heavier. They can wear out tires more quickly. Although we're seeing owners reporting often getting 40,000 miles or more. That's not as good as the normal gas ones are these days, but it's still substantial. They're also less reliable, largely because the technology is new, but they are getting better, and it's a worthy consideration. If you had a bug to get an electric car before, it's worth looking into in some more detail now.
Let's talk about like high car payments, regardless of if they're electric, hybrid, or gas powered. Those prices for car payments are pretty high. What's going on there? Why are more and more people having problems, you know, owning their cars?
Well, the reason is expense. Cars are getting more costly from one end to the other. It's not just the payments. We have the average monthly new car payment in January is $774. Wow. That's up from $588 in January. These things are looking like mortgage payments.
Yeah.
Used to be here. Insurance, gas, repairs, and maintenance, everything considered, the total cost of owning a vehicle has risen more than 40% since January 2020. So a lot of people are having to reconsider, or they want a car of some sort. 53% of consumers said affordability was a primary reason for not considering a vehicle purchase. One thing to realize is that we really shouldn't be buying cars as often as we were, say, 20 years ago. They last longer. The average age of a car on the road now is nearly 13. So we're way done with the time where you should get a new car even every 5 years or so. We have Americans with household incomes of $150,000 or more are making up 43% of new car sales. So if you're not in that range, you may really want to consider something used, something recent. They're lasting a long, long time. So if you find something that has 50 or even 100,000 miles on it, you can save a chunk of money, not to be confused with cheap, but that may be the way to go if you're... The payments are very high, and the other costs going into it are getting higher also.
Well, including some of those gas prices we mentioned. So let's talk about where we are when it comes to oil and stocks, metal, crypto, and other prices from this morning, and how did they change since the last time we talked?
Okay. Over as early this morning, We have gold $42.50 down $733 an ounce. I think that's might be the worst dollar amount in the worst result in 1 week gold has ever had, and one of the worst percentages. I don't really understand it with all the bad things going on in the world. Often gold is a safe haven, but not this time. Silver, $63.78, down almost $15. The ratio between silver and gold is 66.5 to 1. Dow Jones Industrial Average, two different things here. The week, early this morning, it was 45,577 for almost a 1,000-point loss over the past week for the fourth straight plus or minus 1,000 rebate. The good news is it's gained almost that entire amount right now since in today's trading. It liked the situation in Washington with talking about giving Iran more time to free up the Strait of Hormuz and make it seem sort of vague. And it's, as of right now, or I should say as of a 10-minute delay ago, it's up about 900 today. So very close. NASDAQ, same situation, 21,648, down 457 over the past week. Actually worse than the Dow was, but it's up a higher percentage this morning. It's up, it says 466.54. That is a hair more than it went down all last week. So that's looking good. But the last week is really in the books as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. So if we start a good week, that'll be a big improvement. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 99.41, lost 65 cents on the barrel. It saw 112 in the previous week, but it's back down to about where it was before. That's, of course, a direct result of what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz. Bitcoin, 68,239, dropped 4,800 and some. It gave back about 90% of what it gained last week, back to its new area of the 60s. British pound, 1.3304, up 0.6 cents. Euro, 1.1525, up 0.83 cents. Both almost completely gained last week's loss. So it really doesn't seem to be going anywhere long term. And neither is the Japanese 100 yen coin, which is still at 63 cents. So overall, we're floundering in Iraq, Iran. We're probably floundering in Iraq, too. And it may continue. We'll see. We can be optimistic that the bombing and all will stop, but until it does, we're going to have high prices and the Dow is going to be hurting. So we don't know what's going on in our president's mind, so we really don't know. It doesn't seem like we're in control at all on these things. Yeah. So just hang on. You've got no other choice.
Hanging on and keeping an eye on things for us. James B. Huntington with Local Economic Perspective. James B., thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Coming up next, how a new course is digging into the overlooked cultural and political legacy of the Catskills far beyond the hotel era. That's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill.
The Anglican Communion will celebrate the installation of the first female Archbishop of Canterbury this upcoming week. But the new barrier that's broken does not mean equality has been reached.
Our tradition is full of these stories of women who had deep experiences of God, and those stories are also our stories.
I'm Elsa Chang, the rise of women clergy on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. culture in the Catskills goes far deeper than the big name resorts of the Borscht Belt era, and a new online class is taking a closer look at the region's rich history of Yiddish culture, politics, and community life. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Phil Brown, founder of the Catskill Institute and a university distinguished professor at Northeastern University, about the three-session course, Culture, Yiddishkeit, and Politics in the Catskills.
Today, our guest is Phil Brown, and Phil Brown will be leading a three-session online class entitled Culture, Yiddishkeit, and Politics. And that program is hosted by the 92nd Street Wise Roundtable Series. It is running for three consecutive Mondays, beginning on April 13th, and then the 20th and the 27th from 10 to 11 a.m. So we have Phil here, and he can tell us what he's going to be covering in these three sessions and why he chose this particular topic. Welcome.
So many topics to cover about the Catskills. And I had done a class with the 92nd Street Y in the fall, and they had very good attendance and a lot of interest afterwards in having more. And we had a very, very engaged set of questions and comments afterwards. So it really resonates with a lot of people. So when we spoke again with the organizers of the roundtable, they said, what kind of topics could we cover that would be, you know, new and different and would be of interest? And we're actually designing two different series. One is the one that you mentioned this April. It's going to be on culture, Yiddishkeit, and politics. But then probably next fall, we'll have another one called Writing the Catskills. And it's going to be all about literature, from very famous novelists all the way on to current memoirists and anybody who's written about the Catskills.
What a great idea.
Yes, and it's surprising how many people there are who've written novels and poems and short stories and reflections. And we have really a wealth of what I call Catskill studies. So many people writing both in the fiction and nonfiction spheres.
And you are, not to get off topic, but you're also director of the Catskill Institute, I believe?
Yes, so we started that many, many years ago in the 90s with what we thought was a one-time conference that was held at Sunny Oaks Hotel in Woodridge. And it just had such a great response, and people were so interested in hearing about this that they came. But we had pretty much anybody who had ever written about the Catskills. We had people who worked there, who owned small businesses, who owned hotels. We had people who knew all different facets of history, including a lot of the civil rights issues, labor organizing, all the Yiddishkeit culture. We had people who specialized in collecting postcards. We had people who were specialists in architecture, and just an enormous array of people who came together because they loved this legacy and wanted to share it.
It's more than just the hotels and the food and the comedians.
Much more. In fact, one year we co-sponsored it with the Jewish Women's Archive, and the whole theme of that year's conference was on women in the Catskills. Another year we specialized on local businesses, on the year-round businesses that made all that possible, and people who lived there and ran businesses throughout the year.
One of the things I noticed that I was glad you were focusing on was the bungalow communities. They all have such an interesting history.
Right. And if you look at most of the popular culture around the Catskills, it's about the big hotels.
Yes.
And it leaves out a lot of the medium and smaller sized hotels, which were the ones that I was used to, the ones that my parents and I worked in, and of course, one that they even owned. But you rarely see mention of the smaller hotels, and you never see mention of the bungalow colonies, except, you know, in the wonderful film A Walk on the Moon. But otherwise, they're much less featured. And well, there was one book that my colleague and friend Erwin Richman wrote about the bungalow colonies. And then there was a memoirist, Arthur Taney, unfortunately deceased, who wrote a beautiful series of essays about daily life in the bungalow colonies.
I remember seeing a film that a grandchild, one of the few lasting members of a bungalow community, and it was a community of Holocaust survivors.
Yes, well, that was a wonderful, wonderful film. And I was actually on the advisory board that put that together.
Wow.
Yes. And so that particular bungalow colony was a bunch of people who had been mainly in one other colony, and they felt that their experiences were just so different that they needed to be only around other survivors. And so they bought another old colony that was going broke, and they kept it going for many years. It's just a very, very beautiful film.
What is the name of it again, so folks can maybe find it online?
Four Seasons Lodge.
There's so much to talk about, but let's get back to the classes you'll be doing and give us a little synopsis of what you'll be covering in each.
Well, so the first one is going to be hotel culture, and it's basically kind of a walkthrough of the daily life of hotels from the perspective of everybody, the guests, the workers, the owners. My parents worked in hotels all their lives after they lost their own hotel. I worked in many hotels, and I just had a lot of experience over the many years knowing so much about this life. I'm going to actually focus it on one particular hotel, the Seven Gables Hotel in Greenfield Park, as a microcosm of what a small hotel looked like in terms of sharing the life of who owned it, the particular structure of in-law ownership, two different families coming together to run the hotel, all the different relatives who came there and worked, my own experience of my mother as the chef, my father as the concessionaire who ran the casino, the coffee shop, the life of my own relatives who my parents brought there to work as counselors and waitresses and other jobs. Quite recently, got a lot of new material from, so I'll be showing lots of interesting new photos from those years. We're talking, back between, let's say 1956 and 62.
And session two?
So then Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit was very important. A lot of reasons. One is that many people who came to the Catskills in their early years were primarily Yiddish speakers. They wanted a Yiddishkeit culture. They wanted Yiddish humor. They wanted Jewish food. They wanted Yiddish songs. When the singer sang, they didn't want to hear only Broadway shows. They wanted to hear Jewish favorites. And that would be, to the extent possible in Yiddish. There were some resorts that were really completely Yiddishkeit. So there were certain hotels and bungalow colonies that were just totally focused on Yiddishkeit culture. And, areas, Isaac Bashev, the singer himself, was a resident at one of these in Woodridge. And the culture of these places was, designed to preserve Yiddish. Another large part of the Yiddishkeit culture was the workman's circle, now called the worker's circle. They had a number of their centers were up there. They ran a sanatorium for tuberculosis patients. They had cemeteries. They had their own set of branches to provide information for people and resources and social support and cultural support, teaching Yiddish in their shulas. And then there was also a lot of Yiddishkeit through some of the organizations. The Jews couldn't get insurance for their farms. The early settlements, there were farmers. They couldn't get fire insurance. So they had their own cooperatives of just Jewish members. They took all their notes and held their meetings in Yiddish. The Hotel Keepers Associations, I have in our archives, books of records of their meetings, they took notes in Yiddish. So there was a very important sense of this is a place to be Jewish, even if you're not primarily focusing on Yiddish culture in the sort of more scholarly way that we now do with organizations like YIVO or American Jewish Historical Society.
And that brings us to the third session, which is politics.
Yes. Well, so in a lot of ways, politics was important. The worker circle was socialist, very involved in a lot of politics, and worker circle had a big influence up there. There were also labor Zionist camps up there training people to make aliyah to Israel. And then there were hotels that were themselves leftist, ranging from some that were affiliated with the Jefferson School and the Communist Party to others that were just more generically leftist. And my mother was the chef for many years at Chait's Hotel in Accord in Ulster County, which was, generically leftist. They were people who had lots of kind of high culture. Instead of having the usual entertainment, they would bring up musicians, and they would have classical musicians playing at night in the lobby while working during the day in the dining room and in the kitchen. You had other places like Maud's Summeray, hotels that were quite expressly political. And these were places that would have entertainers like Paul Robeson, intellectuals and entertainers of the time. A lot of labor organizing. Some of the places like the Steam Laundry in Woodridge, which supplied the hotels with most of their linens. There was a very well-known attempt to organize there. In fact, there's a new book called The Red Hotel, Tribute to a Lost World by Lita Slutsky Newman Moses from the Slutsky family. These were the folks who owned also the Neverly Falls View, which were very large and very well-known hotels. So that's a very interesting connection there, too, is I'm going to open the class with a memoriam to two people who recently passed away who are very important in the Catskills history in different ways. One of them was Elaine Grossinger Edis, the daughter of Jenny Grossinger, who ran the hotel for many, many years and in later years worked in the hospitality industry in Florida. And the other person we'll memorialize is Neil Sedaka, a very, very important musician who's the son-in-law of one of the co-owners of the Esther Manor, a hotel that I knew well and whose family I was in touch with in their last years.
You can register for this webinar by going to the 92nd Street Y website. So thank you, Phil, for taking the time to share this with our listeners, and have fun in your webinar.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak to the listeners, and I hope I'll see some of them in the class.
And thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this show and all of our locally produced programming at our website, wjffradio.org. Just go to the shows tab and you'll find the locally produced shows and podcasts. It's wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill Local News, Culture, and NPR. Today's weather breezy and colder. We might see a little snow, but little or no accumulation. Maybe a leftover snow shower this afternoon into the early evening. Today's high only 37. Tonight, low of 23. It'll be a little breezy as well. It's going to warm up, but then it will be noticeably cooler weather again Friday and Saturday. Hang on, it's spring. Tomorrow, 44 for a high, partly sunny. Wednesday, 46, up to 61 on Thursday, and a couple of afternoon showers. This is Radio Catskill. On Point is coming up next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
It's 11 o'clock.